Dateline Washington, Monday, June 1st, 2009. Hello again from the nation's capital. I'm Greg Corumbus. In this edition, when will the government intervention stop? We'll speak with Dan Eikenson of the Cato Institute, who's worried that the government will now start favoring General Motors to the detriment of Chrysler and Ford. We'll also find out what other industries the government might be interested in affecting as a result of the current economic crisis. Also in this edition, General Motors' reaction to General Motors entering bankruptcy. We'll discuss today's developments and what may lie down the road with John Smith, Vice President for Global Product Planning at General Motors. Plus, the healthcare debate is now in full swing. We'll speak with Amy Menefee, Policy Advisor and Spokesperson for Patients United Now, a new coalition opposed to the brand of healthcare reform being pushed by President Obama and the democratically controlled Congress. And why did the Air France plane disappear over the Atlantic? We'll speak with independent airline analyst David Field. All that, plus Monday's headlines, are straight ahead on Dateline Washington. We begin with the General Motors bankruptcy, and we begin right now. My first guest in this edition is Dan Eikenson, Associate Director of the Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute here in Washington. We want to get his thoughts as President Obama announces pretty much what everyone expected, that General Motors would follow Chrysler into Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection and that the government would be the majority stakeholder. And Dan, thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Not a surprise, but what do you see as the most significant impact of the government taking this step?
Well, yes, I agree. It's not surprising. In fact, it's probably the least shocking news we've heard in over 7 months. And this could actually be the last capitalist act that GM is engaged in. We have problems here with the government taking such a big stake, with taxpayers taking such a big stake in this company. Now the administration has every incentive in the world to see GM succeed, more so than Ford. Or Chrysler because of the sheer value of holdings. So I'm worried that policy is going to be tilted in a way that to benefit GM, to incentivize consumers to buy GM products. It already is to a certain extent. There are already tax write-offs made available to people who buy the Chevy Volt. But I think policy is going to make it is going to hamstring competition. Is going to make help suppress GM's costs vis-a-vis Ford, for example. And ultimately, this is going to make it very difficult for Ford, as much as it wants to stay away from the government and go forward on its own, it's going to make it increasingly difficult for them to do so. And I'm afraid it might chase Ford right into the bosom of the government, and that doesn't bode well for consumers or for our economy generally.
Get a little more specific, if you can, Dan. What other ways might we see this administration or government in general try and favor General Motors as a result of the investment it's making today?
Well, I think they wouldn't be so blatant as to write a law that gives consumers tax benefits for buying GM cars per se, but there might be tax benefits for buying cars that get certain gas mileage or that meet certain standards and happen to be cars that only GM is producing under government mandate. I think our trade policies are going to favor GM. Right now, I understand, as part of this deal, the unions were guaranteed by GM that GM will not import any of its any of the smaller vehicles that it makes overseas to give room for GM's plants here to kind of create that critical mass for itself. Well, that is going to come back to haunt us. That is going to violate our trade agreements. That is going to inspire foreign countries to do similar things, which will affect other industries in the United States. It's going to affect. It's going to incentivize other governments to get behind their own national champions, which is going to make it more difficult for U.S. companies to compete. So. I would like to believe President Obama when he says, look, we want to get out of this business as quickly as possible, but it's awfully tempting to hold GM's hand as long as possible. In 2 years, the UAW contract comes up for renegotiation. Well, in 2 years, we're going to be fairly well into the 2012 election campaign, and I rather doubt that President Obama will sit by idly if the unions get a bad deal from GM management. GM management, the unions are going to go over the heads of Fritz Henderson and the rest of GM management and come straight to Obama and say, what are you going to do for us? And likewise, Congress is going to be involved here because some of the plant closures that have been announced, some of the dealership closures, all of them, are in congressional districts, and some people, Congress people, are hearing from their constituents that they're unhappy about it. So there's a lot of room for politicking here, and this is just not a very good example of how capitalism works.
Dan, you mentioned that Obama calls himself a reluctant majority shareholder in terms of the U.S. government's position here. Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel here where this government majority ownership will no longer be the case, and what sort of scenario do you envision for that happening?
Well, I can't see it happening anytime soon. There were some great statistics. I'll give credit to the Wall Street Journal in an editorial today. They said that at its peak, GM's market capitalization was $60 billion in the year 2000. Since the U.S. government or taxpayers have a 60% share, GM would need to be valued at $80 billion in order for the taxpayer to just break even. Slightly over $80 billion to get 60% of that, you get almost $50 billion. Well, that's a 33% increase in the value of a company from 2000 when it peaked. I don't see that happening next year or the year after. We still have contractions in demand. GM's going to be making products that Americans have traditionally not wanted to buy, so there's going to have to be a lot more money thrown in to induce Americans to buy these products. So I see, five, ten, many years down the road before the taxpayer is made whole again. And so I don't know ultimately if that's going to be the objective, the driving objective all the way through, but certainly that's the driving objective now. So I don't see the government getting out of this business for quite some time.
Dan, how concerned are you that a precedent is being set with what's happening with Chrysler and General Motors that could potentially spill over to other industries, maybe not with the same kind of price tag we're seeing with these two automakers, but just the general principle of industries or sectors of the economy being in trouble, and the government steps in and not only keeps them afloat, but ends up calling a lot of the shots, too?
Yeah, I mean, we've already seen it. It all started out after the first, the financial bailout under the Bush administration and Paulson and Bernanke. We here at Cato were saying, look, there's going to be every other industry is going to line up after this, and lo and behold, the mantra was Main Street versus Wall Street. You know, if you're going to bail out the banks, then you have to bail out Main Street, and you have to bail out the auto companies. I don't think there was a case for either bailout, but after the automakers showed up, then you'd start seeing, parts producers, and you'd start seeing other industries. And I tell you, I live in Washington, and I know that the country is experiencing a very tough recession, but Washington doesn't feel that way. There are a lot of jobs here. The lobbying shops are bloated. People are just lining up to get their bailouts from Washington. And, once you've opened up that can, it's tough to get the worms back in it. And I think that the duration of this administration is going to be littered with examples of government taking care of businesses that have the savviest lobbyists.
And we've heard at least stories of some on Wall Street, and then, like you mentioned, the first round of the TARP bailouts and so forth, who believe they're now in a position to pay back the money that they got through the TARP program, and the government doesn't want it back yet. So does government like having control more than they like having their money back?
That could very well be. Some companies learn their lessons early on, saying, whoa, the government is forcing us into doing things that we don't want to do. They're restricting who we hire, who we lend to, how much we lend. The administration has an agenda, and it's a transformative one, and it's about shifting this economy from a carbon-based economy to a renewable energy-based economy. And in the auto industry, I think that might trump everything else. I mean, the Democratic Party in Congress, in my view, is sort of categorized into two groups. You've got those who care about the big three as a jobs program. They don't care if they make money as long as they're employing people, and that model hasn't worked very well. And then you've got the Greens, the Henry Waxmans, who don't care if the companies make money as long as they're serving as a model of green production for the rest of the world. And, gosh darn, we're going to be making these high-mileage vehicles. They cost 50, 60 grand. People can't afford them, nor do they want them. We'll induce them to want them by subsidizing their purchases to the tune of $20,000 or $30,000 per vehicle. It's not a very productive model, but at least it helps the administration at least uphold the mirage that we are a green economy.
Dan, what will we see, or what have we already seen that might give credence to what you just said, that this position the government's in and with respect to the auto industry and the Obama agenda to reform America's energy production and consumption, what are some of the steps we could see along that road?
Along that road to get us there. Well, this cap and trade legislation that has been before Congress is the step in that direction. Fortunately, I understand, and rightly so, U.S. business is not really willing to sign on to a cap and trade system if we are still importing from countries that don't. That aren't regulated by such a system, so they're proposing throwing up trade barriers, and that is just unfeasible. And as a result, this legislation, this idea, people are coming to grips with the idea that this concept needs reworking. And I don't think it's going to come to pass this year, and maybe not even in this Congress. But if the government is running the auto companies, it doesn't necessarily need a cap and trade system. It can do it all by itself.
And just a few seconds left here. So you believe this Congress will fail to pass the cap-and-trade version that's currently being debated?
I think that this year it will not pass. I think this year it's too controversial. We're getting to the point. I think Americans generally like to play between the 40s, and maybe there was a mandate for this president to try and change the American economy and change the way we think. But Americans don't like change so rapidly, particularly when it's not necessary. And they're pushing back, and I think that Obama and Congress don't want to overplay what they think is their mandate now, and we'll wait until the next year or the next Congress.
Dan, unfortunately, we need to run. Thank you so much for your time today.
You bet. My pleasure.
Dan Eikenson is Associate Director of the Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. This is Dateline Washington.